Hello everyone, I'm Kelly Manns and welcome to the very first episode of my new podcast series, Women Making History. I have decided to start this series with someone that pretty much everyone in the world knows, Joan of Arc. Many people have heard of her heroism through poems and stories or even movies and plays. There are many paintings portraying her riding into battle in her last moments of being tied to a stake. But who was she, really? Well, let's find out. Disclaimer, there are a lot of French names and French locations mentioned in this episode. I don't speak French, but I will do my best to pronounce them correctly. First, I'm going to give you a little backstory into what was going on when Joan was born that she would ultimately play a large part in her later life. Joan of Arc was born in 1412 in the village of Domremy, located in northeastern France. At the time of Joan's birth, France and England were in a bitter conflict and had been for years. That conflict would later be known as the Hundred Years' War. At this point, England had the upper hand. In 1420, a peace treaty was enacted that disinherited the Crown Prince of France, Charles of Valois, and instead made King Henry V ruler of both England and France. By this time, England, along with their French allies, occupied a good portion of northeastern France. As a result, many families in the region, including Joan's in 1428, would leave their homes behind and flee in search of safety from the attacks and assaults on their villages. All of these events that were going on at the time of her birth, like I said, will play a major role in her life later. Living as a peasant during Joan of Arc's day was no small task. Joan was born into a peasant family, with her father being a farmer. Joan had two older brothers, a younger brother, and a younger sister. The children would have all been brought up learning to be a farmer. The majority of peasants' time was spent working the land to be able to simply survive for another year. If they weren't toiling away in the fields or at their jobs, they would most likely be involved in some type of church activity, such as mass, a feast, prayer, and so on. The feast days would mark when they could take a break from their work and rest, as well as marking the harvest days and the planting days each season. The church played a very prominent role in the day-to-day lives of peasants at that time. Peasants of Joan's time also lived in almost total obscurity, with their births, their lives, and their deaths rarely, if ever, documented. Because of this, not a lot is for sure known about Joan's early life. Most accounts of her early life came from Joan herself at her later trial, which I will talk about later in the episode. Peasant women in the Middle Ages, in my opinion, had it the hardest. They had their own chores and work to do, such as cooking, cleaning, tending the children, mending or making clothes, tending their own little vegetable plot for their family, and looking after any of the smaller animals that they may have had, but then on top of that were expected to help with their husband or father's chores and work, like planting the crops or harvesting them. Women of the time were also required to be subordinate and subservient to the men in their lives, whether that be their husband, brother, father, or other male kinsmen. Life for women then is a far cry from the independence and freedoms that most of us women get to enjoy today. Joan was ahead of her time, however, and she was determined to forge her own way in order to follow the path that she believed was set before her by God. As was the norm in her day, Joan was never taught to read or write. Nevertheless, Joan's mother instilled a deep love of the Catholic faith and all of its teachings. Because of this, she understandably displayed a very religious and sensitive temperament from a very early age. According to some accounts, people around Joan described her as very pious and committed to serving God and the Blessed Mary. Joan was 13 years old when she had a vision for the first time and heard the voice of God. She was standing in the family garden when that happened. Her visions were mystical and usually accompanied by a bright light and Saint Michael or Saint Catherine. Joan felt herself to be guided by these visions and voices. At her later trial, she would say that these visions were often preceded by the ringing of church bells for Mass. She would then run as fast as she could to the church to pray. Joan genuinely and fervently believed that her visions and the voices were messages from God. These voices told her to drive the English forces out of France and see to it that the Crown Prince of France was crowned King of France at Reims. It is a mission that she would eventually die for carrying out. 3 years passed between Joan's first vision and the start of her mission. No one really knows why it took 3 years before she did anything, but as I mentioned earlier, hardly anything was concretely recorded about her early life. So scholars and historians can only speculate as to the reasons why it took her 3 years before she did anything. Maybe her parents stopped her, either because they didn't believe in her visions, or maybe because they just wanted her to have a normal life. Maybe the visions told her when she should start. Or maybe she just simply did not know where to even start. We will never really truly know why she waited. In 1428, Joan's village was attacked by Anglo-Burgundian forces, and she and her family fled for safety. They would later return after the attack was over, but not long after this, Joan would leave her home for the last time. When she left her home for this last time the same year, she would be embarking on what she believed to be her divine mission from God. When Joan left, she made her way to the garrison at Vaucouleurs, which was located 12 and a half miles or 20 kilometers north of her village. Once there, she sought out the captain of the garrison, Robert de Baudricourt. Joan asked him to take her to the Crown Prince. There are some accounts that say Baudricourt laughed Joan away at least twice when she would ask him this before he was convinced of and believed in the seriousness of her mission. However, no one knows for sure what went on between Joan and Baudricourt that finally convinced him of her purpose. In one version of what possibly happened, Joan returned to Baudricourt's office in early 1429. She told him of a French defeat related to the Siege of Orleans before anyone could have possibly known about it. After seeing it to be true, and therefore demonstrating her divine powers, he was convinced and agreed to take Joan to see the Crown Prince. Another version has Joan publicly shaming Baudricourt. She addressed him loudly, mocking him for his lack of faith and haranguing him on his refusal to believe that God had sent her to rid France of the English invaders. It is said that by this time, Joan had a band of followers of her own who believed in her visions. Regardless of what may have been said or done to convince Baudricourt of her purpose, he finally relented and agreed to take Joan with an escort to the Crown Prince at the castle of Chinon, where Charles was currently residing. The journey from Vaucouleurs to Chinon was more than 300 miles, or 480 kilometers. It was an 11-day journey traveling along roads through the middle of enemy territory controlled by bandits. They would travel at night, avoiding towns and even traveling through the wilderness to avoid being seen in order to make it to the castle safely. For this journey, Joan had cropped her hair and donned men's clothing to further aid in their efforts to go unnoticed. In her later trial, Joan would say that she wasn't afraid because God is with her, but I can't help but wonder if she did have any inkling of fear or any seeds of doubt. This would have been a harrowing journey for a 17-year-old girl who had most likely never traveled more than a few miles from her own village her entire life. This is just yet another thing that we will never know for sure about Joan of Arc. After arriving at Chinon, she requested to see the Crown Prince. Charles, having been informed of her arrival to the castle, decided to test her. He dressed as one of his couriers, and he had one of them dressed like him. His reasoning for doing this was that if Joan really was sent by God, she would know him, the true Crown Prince. Makes sense, right? When Joan arrived at the assembly to speak with him, she went straight to Charles, still donned in his courier's garb, and addressed him as the Crown Prince. Charles protested and tried to trick her further, but Joan never wavered. Joan promised Charles that she would see him crowned King of France at Reims, the traditional coronation site of the French royals that was, at that time, in enemy territory. Joan is said to have made a strong impression on Charles, with her passion and with her conviction. It is also said that Joan convinced Charles later, in private, of her legitimacy and her seriousness of her mission when she recounted to him things that he had only said to God in prayer. Charles, however, still needed to prove that Joan wasn't a witch trying to place him under a spell. He had her evaluated by an assembly of clergymen for orthodoxy and purity. The clergyman declared her to be an Orthodox Christian virgin in good standing. Joan then presented herself again to Charles, stating that she was the answer to his problems in Orleans. We will never truly know what was said or what went on between Charles, the Crown Prince of France, and Joan, a teenaged peasant girl hearing voices that persuaded him to grant her an army. But he did just that. Joan was given a squire, a page, some soldiers, and an army, and was sent off to raise the siege of Orleans. Contrary to what many people believe, though, Joan wasn't actually in command of this army. She was just under the command of the court of Dunois, just like the rest of the army. He was also known as the Bastard of Orleans. I'm sure that he found being bossed around by a teenage girl that was a peasant with no military professional training in politics or tactics very trying. At one point in the mission to raise the siege, the Count went against Joan's advice and snuck around the English fortifications to get into Orleans with his army, who were laden with equipment and provisions to avoid a major battle. The Count and his army got stranded on a riverbank, unable to bring their supplies to Orleans by barge because the wind was against them. This infuriated Joan because all she wanted to do was get on with her God-given mission. The Count didn't believe in Joan or her visions, but this is when she made a believer out of him. Joan told the Count that she was bringing him better help than he ever got from any other soldier or city because it is the help from the King of Heaven. The Count claimed that at that moment, the wind changed directions, allowing the barges carrying his army and supplies to cross over to Orleans. Joan had set off to raise the siege of Orleans in March of 1429. She wore white armor and rode a white horse. I have to imagine that she would have been quite the sight to behold. There had been a prophecy circulating in France for years that said a maiden in armor would rise from the region of Lorraine and become the savior of the country. Joan had fulfilled that prophecy by donning her white armor and riding into Orleans with an army at her back. Even though Joan had had absolutely no involvement in the war whatsoever up to this point, the prophecy attached itself to her so readily and so firmly that she was welcomed into the city as a hero. Joan embraced her role as heroine and greeted all of the people of Orleans personally. She would go out among them daily to encourage and inspire them and to deliver food and supplies. Joan provided a much-needed morale boost to the soldiers and civilians of Orleans, who had been under siege by the English at that point for 6 months. The men in charge of the defense of Orleans constantly tried to exclude Joan from the war councils. Joan, however, refused to be deterred. If she couldn't participate, she could at least listen. Joan continued to call for action against the key points in the English line. Because of the way the English conducted their siege, there were gaps open to the city at various intervals. Joan herself, along with some of her forces, had entered the city through one of these gaps on the Loire River, just a few miles east of Orleans. But even knowing that, she was still ignored. Nevertheless, Joan patiently continued to suggest courses of action, as well as continuing to go out among the people, encouraging and inspiring them and lifting their spirits. One day, Joan rallied some troops and led them on a successful assault on the English position of St. Loup. The next day, backed by a civilian militia that had responded to her inspiration, Joan led another successful assault on the English, which broke the siege even further. During these attacks, Joan was wounded in the chest, but despite the wounds, she persevered and carried her standard, inspiring the others to fight on. The siege of Orleans was lifted just 9 days after Joan's arrival. Within a year, Joan led the French army to victory not only at Orleans, but also at Patay and Troyes. Many other cities and towns were liberated from the English control during this time. Joan had won the hearts of the soldiers with her victories. They looked up to her as almost a mythical leader. For her exploits and leadership, Joan and her family were granted a title of nobility. Talk about rags to riches! With Orleans finally saved, and with the other successful engagements freeing the towns along the Loire River from the English, Joan was in a position to realize one of the major parts of her God-given mission, to see Charles crowned King of France. King Charles VII of France was crowned at Reims, following tradition, in July of 1429 with Joan by his side, just as she had promised. This would be the height of her military career, and little did she know then that Charles, the king she had fought so hard for and helped crown and who ennobled her, would essentially throw her to the wolves in a very short time. She would later completely lose his backing and his support. After the coronation of King Charles VII, Joan argued with him that they should press their advantage and reclaim Paris. King Charles, on the other hand, seemed more inclined to pursue diplomacy and to consolidate his gains. This frustrated Joan, but now that she was a noble, she didn't need the king's permission to launch an assault on her own. In the spring of 1430, Anglo-Burgundian forces laid siege to the town of Compiègne. Joan, at the request of King Charles, rushed to the town's defense. In doing so, Joan ignored the fact that a few months prior, her voices had told her that she would be captured by the English. She continued to lead the attacks on the Anglo-Burgundian forces in defense of the town. The Anglo-Burgundian force was much larger than her own. She only had a few hundred men. During one of the assaults she led against the enemy, Joan was thrown from her horse and stranded outside the town walls as the gates closed. She was then captured by the Anglo-Burgundian troops and subsequently sold to the English. When Joan found out that she was going to be handed over to the English, it's said that she threw herself from a tower, possibly in an attempt to commit suicide. I have to say, I don't blame her. She most likely knew what was coming, and that would have been an easier death for her. However, Joan survived this attempt and was taken by the English to Rouen to stand trial. Joan's trial went on for the first 4 months of 1431. During her trial, she was kept in a secular jail where she was constantly harassed and threatened by her male guards, instead of being kept in an ecclesial prison like she should have been, where she would have been tended to and guarded by women. Joan's trial, a veritable farce from the very beginning, was very well documented and gives a good look into the mindset of Joan. In her trial, Joan was charged and ordered to answer to over 60 charges, including witchcraft, heresy, and dressing as a man. The French King Charles, who Joan had helped crown, made no effort to get her back in any way, either through ransom or prisoner exchange. At the same time, the English were bound and determined to get rid of this young female leader while also discrediting Charles, who she had helped crown. A group of clerics were called upon to denounce Joan's orthodoxy and purity at her trial. They refused to participate in any way at all until their lives were threatened by the English. Throughout the duration of her trial and interrogations, Joan defended herself ably. Some of the quotes we know today came from her defense of herself during her trial. She surprised her prosecutors with her sharp wit, so much so that they decided to continue the trial behind closed doors. Joan was threatened with torture, which would have been normal at the time, but there's no evidence to suggest that this threat was actually carried out. As was expected, Joan of Arc was found guilty of heresy and was sentenced to death by burning at the stake. A horrible, painful way to die. Faced with death by fire, Joan recanted her claims to have been directed by God to free France from the English and confessed that she had lied. Again, I can't blame her for this, as a sentence of death by fire would have been terrifying. However, a week later, Joan recanted her recantation, stating that she was in fact directed by God, but by recanting her confession, that meant that her death sentence would have been reinstated and carried out. Joan of Arc was burned at the stake in Rouen's Market Square on May 30th, 1431. She was just 19 years old. It is said that over 10,000 people attended her execution. According to the witnesses, Joan faced her ordeal with dignity. Joan is said to have called upon Jesus throughout her execution. I can't even begin to imagine what was going through her mind as the flames licked her ankles and her legs. I would have been many things if I was in her place, but dignified would not have been one of them. To add insult to injury, the court ordered her body be burned two more times to ensure that she was, in fact, dead. Her ashes were then thrown into the River Seine. 26 years after Joan of Arc was burned at the stake, the English were finally driven from France. A later inquest declared Joan to be innocent, and she was officially designated as a martyr. And in case you were wondering, King Charles VII of France, who Joan had helped crown and gave her life for, proved to be unworthy as a monarch in every single way. Joan of Arc was canonized as a saint for the Catholic Church in 1920. To this day, she remains the patron saint of France. Joan accomplished so many achievements in her short life and inspired so many people. Imagine what she could have accomplished had she lived. She pushed the gender barriers of her day in a world ruled by men. She was the definition of courage and perseverance, as well as being a model of humility. She was loved by many, and her life helped change the course of French history. Although scholars and historians have tried to explain away her visions, usually as some form of mental illness, none have been able to do so. She was centuries ahead of her time, and she still continues to inspire people today, just as she did then. She is a woman who definitely made history. Well, that does it for this episode. I hope you are all taken back in time hearing about Joan of Arc and her life. Thank you all for joining me, and let me know your thoughts and opinions about today's episode on Facebook and Instagram under Women Making History. Don't forget to subscribe and follow so you don't miss out on an episode. And remember, go out and make a difference. Bye!